New Realities is dedicated to exploring evolving human potentials in an evolving world. This series explores the idea of how to become more conscious beings. We present programs that invite the viewer to look at automatic behaviors and take free rein of their body, mind, and spirit so that we can hope to inhabit and create a better world. And now our host of New Realities, Alan Steinfeld.
Well, thank you, Maria.
You're welcome.
Brand new announcer, Maria...
Maria Marilli,
and this is New Realities, and I'm Alan Steinfeld, and each week I like to bring the latest in our spiritual potential, what's happening, how we're evolving our consciousness. And at the beginning of the show, I usually make some initial announcements. Is that good, Maria?
Great.
Okay, good. We're having good sound here today. And So I'd like to say the first thing that's coming up is I'm going to be hosting a panel called The Art and Science of the Light Body with Alex Gray and J.J. Hertog. That is Thursday, April 19th at a place called the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors. That's 540 West 27th Street. And you can check that out at COSM, chapelofsacredmirrors.org, COSM.org. And then on Saturday the 21st, I'll be conducting something called an intention experiment with Lynn McTaggart, who wrote a book called The Intention Experiment. And we'll be doing a group intention to change the environment. And we'll be hooked up via the internet to Arizona and to England. And we'll be sending collective thoughts in order to change the environment, particularly in Arizona. So that's what's coming up right now. And what else is happening, Maria? Talk to me.
So much. What isn't happening, Alan?
No. you can tell people that I do a television show. And
of course you do. 12 years now on Channel 57.
Channel 57 in New York. That is also called New Realities. And you can check that out at newrealities.tv. And also you can check that out on YouTube. There's a lot of my old interviews on YouTube, people with like Deepak Chopra, for instance, and J.J. Hertog, who you'll get to meet if you're in New York on Thursday. And I just also want to tell people that there's something else. I'm still taking a trip to Italy, to Domenhor, which is a collective community of spiritual seekers living in the north of Italy. That's Domenhor. And
how much is it?
That is, well, people can call me if they're interested in coming. It's
well, that's always the question, right?
Well, it's under $2,000.
That's good. That's a bargain.
For a week of spiritual commune with the mountains, with this amazing temple that was built into the mountain. We're leaving April 27th. We'll be back April 5th or 6th, depends if you're going to stay longer. So that's happening, and people can actually call me if they're really interested. That's the information on that is Domenhor, Damanhur, and you can leave a message if that sounds interesting at 212-473-6388 or email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. I also want to tell people there's a Divine Feminine Conference, and if you were listening to my show last week, I was interviewing the founder of that conference named Finbar Ross, and he has something called Celtic Mystery Journeys, and he'll be doing a conference in New York City on Awakening the Divine Feminine, and that's at the Meta Center. That's 214 West 29th Street. I know this is local, but Finbar will also be taking his... bunch of goddesses, his bevy of goddesses, would you say, around the country. And the number to call him at Finbar, if you're interested in the Awakening the Goddess conferences that will be happening everywhere in all the major cities, his number for reservations and information is 877-756-8763. Now, one more very special announcement before we get to our first guest, and that is that I am hosting a Tantra weekend, and Tantra is the art of conscious loving. It's an ancient Hindu practice, and that will be with Charles Muir, who's also been the guest on this show. You can check the archives. I think that was 2 weeks ago, and in March, that Charles was our guest on the show. And Tantra really is about the practice of understanding the power of connection, increasing intimacy, expressing spiritual and sensual union.
Mm-hmm.
He also does healing and awakening the sexual energies.
And couples attend this? Couples.
Good question, Maria. No, you can attend on your own, or if you are with somebody and you want to get closer to them, and you're not going to get any closer than a tantric weekend, you can come with a couple. But if you're single and would like to attend and know more about sensuality and sexuality, this is really a great workshop. So let me just give people a number to contact for Charles Muir, and he's also all over the country traveling around, but in New York he'll be here the 4th to the 6th of May 2007, and a number about that is 212-777-0794, and he's also at sourcetantra.com. Do you understand what Tantra is, Maria?
You know, I've heard a lot about it, but I don't really. I've never had the pleasure of experiencing Tantra.
Well, I'll have to show
you. You'll have to show me sometime, Alan.
I'll have to show you after the show.
Okay.
So. But we'll be off the air by then. So anyway, no, Tantra really is a way of consciously connecting. You know, most people are unconscious in their sexuality. It's like just the animal part of them. Tantra is really about making sexuality more human, more divine, actually.
Oh, from all chakras.
All
opening,
chakras, not just one chakra.
Right.
It's a total chakra experience. Anyway, that will be coming up at the beginning of May, and really, if you have a question, I totally recommend that. And if you are a listener to the show, you can say you're a listener to New Realities, and you'll get $50 off the workshop. Normally, it's $450. You can get it for $400. So the number to call for that is 212-777-0794. Okay. So I have two guests tonight on the show. One is an astrologer who will be introduced, and the other is a person I just talked to on the phone named Jim Fitzner. And Jim will be the second guest, but just a little background about him is that he is talking about the evolution of intelligence and what is the aspect of the human mind. And that's really what New Realities is all about, how to explore the mind and the understanding of our reality. Our first guest, do you want to just introduce
the
first guest? I don't know if she's on the phone yet, but give us a little rundown about who she is.
Sure. Rebecca Gordon is a professional astrologer in New York City. She sees clients weekly. She has a city office, and she also does speaking engagements. She's coming out with a newsletter beginning in May called Astro Time. And you can find Rebecca on her website at lifepathastro.com. That's LIFEPATHastro.com. She's a columnist, a speaker, and does private consultations. So Rebecca Gordon will be hearing about it.
Okay, we just have another minute. But the thing that I like to introduce about astrology is not that I'm an avid astrologer. It's just that astrology gives us a perspective on outer cycles. It's a reflection of who we are. I don't think astrology is predictive.
No.
I think it reflects who we are in the universal cycle of things. You know, so everything has a cycle.
Yeah.
And astrology somehow shows us what's happening outside of ourselves that reflect what's happening inside of ourselves. I think that's why I like to reference astrology. Rebecca was also a speaker at a 2012 conference that I hosted, and she gave us the background behind the astrological configurations of 2012. And if people don't know what 2012 is, I'll be doing a show about that in the upcoming weeks. But just to give you a little insight, is what 2012, December 21st, 2012, is what the Mayans said was the end of their calendar. It ends at sunrise on the winter solstice on December 21st, 2012. And when we reach that date, people say we will shift into a new time period. So Rebecca gave me some background about that. But tonight,
you can almost feel the acceleration, right? I mean, we're now in this time of, we're getting closer to 2012, so they're...
Well, that's exactly right.
Like,
it feels like more people are waking up and more people are going to sleep also. So we're in a time of huge polarity. I'm going to do a whole show about that, and Rebecca will be on the show. But tonight she is talking about a new planet named Eris. And I thought it was Eros, but it's not. It's Eris. So Rebecca, are you on the line?
I'm on the line.
Hello,
Alan.
Rebecca.
Hello?
She's gone. Can we get her?
Oh, yeah, there she is.
Rebecca.
Hi, Alan.
Hi. Okay, did you hear the introduction?
Yes, I heard you.
Okay,
excellent.
Good.
That was great,
finally,
Alan. Thank
you. You finally spoke up. Good.
Hi.
So I wanted to say you're an esoteric astrologer, so you're not just talking about what's going to happen in people's lives and all that, but you're connecting it to the actual soul's journey, right?
Exactly. What we're looking at, too, is major cycles of our collective consciousness as the Earth, not just individuals. And in astrology, we can look at individual charts very easily. And another thing which I love to do is look at new planets, new objects being discovered out there, and see how they reflect on the collective consciousness as us as a whole. So today we'll be talking about Eris.
Okay.
What it means for us as a planet.
Eris. Now, you have to tell people first that people don't even know we have a new planet. I mean, they got rid of Pluto. Now, did we replace it with a new planet?
Exactly. Okay, I know. There's been...
And what makes something a planet to begin with?
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, this is all constantly changing in the astronomical community. As many of you have heard, Pluto became demoted and to a dwarf planet. And,
a dwarf planet. Does that mean it doesn't lose its astrological significance, right? There's this whole...
I have to say, it has absolutely nothing to do with the astrological significance.
But, you know, it could, but let me just throw out a question for you. I know we didn't say we talked about this, but the question is, it was demoted by the astronomers which found it. When you find a new planet, it comes into the consciousness of the collective. So when it's demoted to something else, wouldn't it lose its significance in the same sense in a person's chart?
That's an interesting point. Nobody has brought up before. And come to think of it, the meaning of Pluto, well, as many of you know, it rules the sign of Scorpio and the underworld, are unconscious, what's going on behind the scenes. And as a culture right now, there's one thread where we are pretty much trying to hide a lot of what's going on behind the scenes as a collective.
So you think the demoting of Pluto was giving a free rein to hide something?
Well, as a culture, I mean, in this war that we're in and in many other levels, we are, in a sense, hiding what's going on. Many Plutonian aspects are trying
to... Like what? Like the conspiracy stuff? Is that what you mean?
Weapons of mass destruction, all of these ideas that are predominating our news and media right now.
Right. So we're hiding something, yes.
There's definitely so much being put under the surface, and Pluto does rule the underworld and all things hidden, so that... could have a different correlation there.
Okay, so let's talk about Eris, this new planet that was discovered, and what it means and how it affects the collective.
It is so exciting. Okay, on January 5th, 2005, astronomers had noticed that there was something out there, and it was taking such a long time to orbit our sun.
January 5th, 2005, like just recently?
Just very recently. But they did not put it in the media right away because in the astronomical community, they like to study it a bit more first. So we really didn't get word of this until around August of 2006. Many people didn't find out about it.
Wait, let me just ask you, when the astrologers hear that astronomers, found something new, do they all just like, not faint, but they all just like have their mouths watered, how it's going to fit into the new scope of the individual and collective?
I certainly do. I mean, I can't wait to start doing research on these new planets.
Wow.
A lot of astrologers
So 2006, just last year, this thing came into the collective consciousness.
Exactly. This is so recent. The last time a planet was discovered was, of course, Pluto. And when we look at Pluto and Uranus and other planets at the times they were discovered, they will represent aspects in our collective consciousness. For example, Pluto was discovered exactly when the atomic bomb started creation.
Really? So that's like a character trait of Pluto is this, would you say mass destruction, or what would you say?
Destruction and rebirth. Pluto represents the phoenix in mythology. Out of the ash, out of the ashes, you rise.
So okay, and out of the rash, you rise.
Comes
yes.
Rebirth.
Okay. And look at Japan now, you know, it has risen, and it's really come into a whole new center of culture. So, yes. So, okay, so, yes.
Oh, okay, I was just going to bring one more example, the planet Uranus.
Okay.
That planet
yes.
rules sudden change and
okay.
Electricity. That was just, and also revolution. It was discovered at the time people wanted freedom, the French Revolution, and that was in 1781. So
we have this new planet, Eris, which, and what is Eris connected? What was Eris?
Okay.
E-R-I-S.
E-R-I-S, right. Well, in mythology, when we look at it, astronomers and astrologers had spent many days trying to name this planet appropriately.
Now, what would be appropriate? What kind of Greek
okay.
name would be appropriate for a piece of, you know, rock orbiting the sun? I mean,
well,
I'm joking, but how would they know what's appropriate?
As we know, Mars, the planet Mars, is named after god of war, Aries. And
right.
I look at Mars in a person's chart, or in any chart of a company or anything, it represents the assertion, the drive, and the energy, the passion. So,
right.
And that's very appropriately named Mars, Venus, goddess of love. So we look at Eris, and you may remember Xena. People were calling this Eris planet Xena for a long time until it...
Well, is Xena not a planet now, or is Xena a planet?
Xena is the same thing as Eris.
Oh,
and
so it's a kind of semi-planet. So Xena was a kind of warrior goddess type thing, right?
Right. Xena is Eris. Eris is just the official name for what people...
Oh, Xena is Eris.
Yes.
Oh, well, who decided to give it the name Eris as opposed to... I like Xena better.
A lot of people do. So many people were upset about that. It's really funny. Xena was actually a very appropriate name. It just didn't have all of the mythological significance the astronomers wanted. And in fact, Xena was appropriate for a few reasons. I'll explain that. Eris,
yes.
in mythology, is the daughter of Zeus and sister of Ares, god of war. And Xena most definitely portrays a goddess of war. In every
right.
way, a perfect blend of the masculine and feminine energies.
That's
okay.
Xena, but Eris
now,
is...
Now, Eris in mythology is the sister of Mars, sister of Ares.
Oh,
and
not the daughter, the sister.
The sister of Ares and the daughter of Zeus, right.
Uh-huh.
So, in mythology, she was a bit of a troublemaker, and
uh-huh.
she ruled... There's a few circumstances where she kind of encouraged people maybe to push forward, take that competitive edge to win the Olympics, or cause them to go into battle, jealousy,
mm-hmm.
strife, warfare. All of these aspects are Eris.
Mm-hmm.
And what we can look at, too, is when we see Xena, who's this kind of blend of masculine, feminine,
that
and what's coming
so
into
amazing.
Our culture.
Because you can feel it.
What's that? I'm sorry.
Oh, Alan's back.
No, I didn't. Hi, we're back, Rebecca. What
okay.
I meant. No, go ahead. Keep going.
Issues such as gay marriage, church and state.
What did you say? Eris rules gay marriage?
Well, I wouldn't want to say Eris rules gay marriage, but I'm just talking about a few things coming into the media right now.
Uh-huh.
Certain states are banning gay marriage. Certain states are saying it's against the Constitution, certain countries to ban it, like Switzerland. I mean, it's just in the topic, in the media right now. Another thing, we're just looking at predominant aspects in our cultures. Peace treaties being signed, as well as more wars being declared.
So these are all flavors of Eris, you're saying.
I'm sorry?
This is all like a flavor of the Eris energy that's now been brought into the planet.
Exactly. She might rule lawlessness. And
lawlessness?
Lawlessness. Well, it's the whole discrepancy is, we look at right now in our culture, things that we have suicide bombers, murder, death penalty, and war. All of these different kinds. Now, what is lawful and what is lawless? And this kind of relates to the sign of Libra as well. So some people might say that it could be a co-ruler for the sign of Libra.
Oh, I see. So it'll be a planet that's predominant as for Librarians.
Right. I want to confirm that it is a dwarf planet, along with, they're calling Pluto a dwarf planet, and Ceres as well. So the three of these
Ceres
are
another planet?
Ceres is now considered a dwarf planet, along with Pluto and Eris.
Oh, I see. So now, if you chart Eris in someone's, birth chart, how would you interpret it?
Well, what I'm thinking now, it really takes many years to see how these planets are operating in the natal charts. We do see an issue of lawful and lawlessness coming into the picture, and also a bit like the planet Uranus, disruption of the status quo, society versus human individual rights. There's a strong emphasis on human rights here. So it could be what we think we are owed as people, what individually we feel is right versus wrong, good versus evil. Are these actual elements? Is it society? Is it our earth? It's this whole polarity influence that it's bringing into the picture, which is a clear representation of the scales. So it's the earth is trying to find a balance now. I mean, 2005, we had more hurricanes than any other year, and the earth is desperately searching for balance right now. So the discovery of Eris seems to me as there is a plea for balance in this world, and right now we especially need it. So this planet surely is appropriate to the time that we're living in right now. In order to look at how it's operating in the chart, we do need to do more research, however. But it could relate to all of those things.
Hey, Rebecca? Rebecca?
It's Alan.
Hi, Alan.
Sorry, we lost you.
That's okay.
It's, it is working out the bugs in our radio technology here. But the last thing I remember you saying was that Eris you weren't sure it had affinities to Uranus.
Right. Well, as far as lawfulness and lawlessness, and Uranus, is about revolution and breaking the law suddenly. Since Eris is moving so slowly, do you know how many years it takes for Eris to travel around?
No. I mean, more than Pluto?
Take a wild guess.
Well, how many years?
556.7 years.
So that's now a new cycle for us. So really, because I think you can go out on a limb and just say what your real feeling about how this planet is really impacting the collective, because I think these planets give us something to be aware of.
They definitely do.
So what do you think it is? Because you are an esoteric astrologer, and let's look at it generationally, not personally, because it is an outer planet, and it does have
right.
to do more with collective consciousness.
Very much collective.
So give us a hardcore thing of what it has to do with.
I think it's about our human rights.
Human rights.
I really do.
You think it really is configuring a new level of human rights for our culture?
Mm-hmm.
Explain that a little bit, and then go ahead.
Okay, human rights. I mean, what's being put in the media now? What people are craving more? I mean, as the clamps are coming further and further down, people. We look at the United States, we look at the rest of the world, all over. I mean, the weapons, the stakes are being raised everywhere. We're looking at church and state, gay marriage. This is an issue now everywhere. War is huge right now. So many peace treaties, and also it seems as war treaties have been signed in the last 2 years. It's all about the rights, individual rights and collective rights, and how far is the government infringing on this? And
so this new energy coming in will help add to something, right?
Yes, it's really making us aware of our innate human rights. what we're really allowed. It's really to open up our eyes to that, I believe.
Right. Good. And then can you just fit it into the whole thing? Because I know you talk about esoterica, which is the adventure of the soul, right, as incarnate beings, as consciousness. You know, planets then are associated with levels and evolution of consciousness. And so if this new energy is making available, how does that fit into the whole soul's journey of awareness?
It's also connecting us. I mean, people say with the planet Pluto, which was rotating very slowly far out there, it's connecting us to the deeper level of our relationships, interpersonal relationships. This planet is connecting us on a much deeper level with our race, with our species, with our society, with our collectiveness, connectedness to each other.
So humanity will, in a way, can start to come together as oneness.
Exactly. People will begin to start realizing this more and more we're in a window while it's being discovered. It was so recently discovered. So we'll see over the next few years, over the next 50 years or so, more aspects of this being into the collective. But it is basically about understanding the other on a deeper level, but not like Pluto. This is much further out there. This is understanding the collective, the interconnectedness of everybody as a whole, and our rights in general as people.
So I would say where this intersects someone's chart is how much they're dedicated to giving back to the collective, how much service they want to give to humanity, right?
I think it deals with service as well as its fairness. Fairness is an issue here, too. Because
what is an issue?
Fairness.
Fairness, okay.
And really, I mean, what we see now in our culture is this greed and lust is so prominent, and many things are being hidden from us right now. And fairness is very hard to find, and people are looking for this. They're looking for their rights, and people are very confused about this right now. It's going to be brought into light. There's going to be a microscope put on our individual rights and our connectivity to each other, but not just to the person sitting next to you, as a whole, to this, to these people on the other side of the world and to this planet. Our level of connectivity in our DNA is going to raise. And I have to say,
let's talk more about this on an upcoming show. Can we do that?
Yes, sure.
Just tell people how to reach you on your website, okay?
Okay. My name is Rebecca Gordon. And
right, I should have said that. Sorry.
Okay, that's all right. And my website is www.lifepathastro.com.
Lifepathastro.com. Thank you, Rebecca. And we'll also do a show about, the 2012 stuff and how that fits into the evolution of our consciousness as well.
Right.
Okay?
Sounds great.
Right. Thanks for being a guest on New Realities, all right?
Thank you, Alan.
I'll talk to you soon. I'll give you a call later.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Thank you. That was Rebecca Gordon. We have another guest coming up with just a little break. Okay, this is Alan Steinfeld back with New Realities. I was just talking to Rebecca Gordon, and she was talking about this new planet, this new discovery, and how that impacts on human consciousness. My next guest is someone named James Fetzner, and he is he's a distinguished McKnight University professor emeritus at the University of Minnesota in Duluth. He's at the Department of Philosophy. And the thing I really want to talk to James Fetzner about, although he has an amazing range of topics he does talk about, I want to talk about the evolution of consciousness, the evolution of intelligence, mentality, and creativity. A lot of things that I've been actually trying to understand and write about is how we know what we know, what is it that we don't know? How do we know what we don't know? And how do we
I'm sorry about this, Alan. I've been
Alan? Okay, do we have Don? We have a next guest?
No. Yeah, you know
what happened?
I phoned him. He gave me another number. I phoned the other number. It rings, 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 ring. Then I try to phone him back on the number you originally gave me. No answer. Hang up. No answer. So I'm just... we'll get him, hopefully.
Okay, try him again. He gave you another number. I'm going to try him on my phone and see if he picks up, actually. And is there a number to reach you? Are we on the air now?
Yeah, we're on the air. I'm going to try him. I'll try him right now on the number you gave me.
I am right now. He did give you another number.
He did, but he's not answering it.
Number there, James. Calling you now, right?
Yes, this is the number that no one answered, or that this isn't the
okay.
first number I got, but
okay.
no one but the second number doesn't work.
Oh, so call him on that 608 number, okay?
On the 60, okay.
Okay.
Oh, wait.
I'm just going to call you
wait,
back on
wait.
The 608.
Maybe
okay?
this will work. Maybe I can phone it with.
Oh,
wait.
Oh, he's going to try on the other.
I'm going to try it on this line.
Are you going to try one?
I know, you know, it could be these VoIP lines won't connect up to certain lines, you know?
Okay.
And that could
so,
be.
Okay, we'll
there he is. We
in.
Got him. We
through.
Got
okay.
him on this other line.
Okay.
Okay. We'll put him on right now.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. James.
Yes.
Are you with us?
I am indeed, Alan.
Are you on the cell phone or the house
no,
phone?
I'm on the landline.
Okay, great, great, great. Now, when I was looking at the topics that you've been studying and interested in, that this is exactly the kind of things I've been researching, which is like the evolution of cognition. How do we
yeah.
know what we know? How do
yeah.
we bring things into the articulation of our reality? I mean, this is why I do this show. I call the show New Realities. Did
okay.
Paula tell you about it?
Yeah, she mentioned it to me, yes.
So it's about perceptions. How do we expand our perceptions of,
yep.
of the world around us?
Yep.
And the thing that I've been trying to understand about perception is that, you know, the world is chaos. We live in an unfathomable world, but what we've been taught through our cultural upbringing is how to create a cosmos, a pattern out of the chaos and create... ways of relating to this world. So we form a cognition and then a recognition of things around us, and then we call that reality. Does that sound like the kind of stuff you've been studying?
Well, I put it a little bit differently. I mean, for example, there are constant properties in the world that are usually referred to as the laws of nature, laws of physics, chemistry, biology. For example, you know that when the temperature hits 32 degrees, if you're dealing with pure water at atmospheric temperature, it's going to freeze. If it's above that temperature, it's going to be liquid and so forth. If you get above 212, you're going to have it in a form of steam. So, you know, here you have an interesting substance that can be a gas or a liquid or a solid. But because of those laws, we can actually create a coherent picture of the world, even though other parts of it are constantly changing.
Right. So the laws that we define nature are also... confine us in nature as well. Don't you think, I mean, I'm going
well,
a little
well, sure, because these laws, cannot
yeah.
be violated, they cannot be changed, and they require no enforcement. Unlike, say, laws of society, like a speed limit law, I frequently test that law, and I've discovered regularly that it is possible to violate that law.
Okay, right, of course. But so the laws of nature are how we make sense. It's the beginning. Science is understanding the laws of nature.
That's exactly right. The aim of science is to discover the laws of nature, physics, biology, psychology, and
okay.
so forth.
Right. So how does other things like miracles, things that seem to come outside these established laws of nature, come about? I mean, I'm just throwing that out there because, you know, I believe that things seem to come outside the laws of nature. I mean, there are things that sometimes... Do you believe in that or am I trying to...
We have so much evidence supporting the laws of nature that in order to justify a claim that a law of nature has been violated, it must be more improbable that those who are attesting to the violation are wrong, then it is improbable that the law has been violated. That's a very high standard.
But the other thing is, let me just ask you, and we'll pick up where you said, is that perhaps we don't know the whole law. I believe there are definitely laws of nature, but perhaps we're only seeing the surface of the law and not seeing the full scope.
It falls out slightly differently. What it means is that for a statement of a law to be true, you have to take into account the presence or absence of every factor whose presence or absence makes a difference to the truth of the law. So if you exclude some factor, then you can have a statement that seems to be exceptionalist, but actually when those unspecified variables are taken into account, you do have exceptions. It's like if you talked about striking a match in the earth, you know, on the earth, and you talk about the chemical composition of the match and the way the match is struck and that the match is wet or dry. If you don't specify oxygen, then if you go to an oxygen-depleted atmosphere and try to repeat the same experiment, it won't light precisely because there's no oxygen present. So you have to take that into account.
Right. So there's countless variables, and it seems like within a specific law of nature, right? I mean, there's lots of variables.
Yeah. There's going to be a set of variables and you have that are relevant variables that make a difference to the outcome you're interested in, and that specifying the values for those variables is going to allow you to test the hypothesis that you'll get a certain outcome under those conditions.
Okay, I'm with you. So how does consciousness now fit into the laws of nature?
Well,
what is consciousness and how does it fit in?
Consciousness is an extremely interesting topic. My views about consciousness is that the mind operates in terms of things that stand for other things. These can be things that look like other things, like photographs, films, pictures, realistically, you know, characterized as opposed to, say, abstract art. It can be causes or effects, like smoke stands for fire, fire stands for smoke, ashes stand for fire, elevated temperature and red dots can stand for the measles. Or there is a third class of what are known as signs, which are symbols.
Yeah, this is understanding signs and symbols, epistemology, all that, yeah.
Because they don't look like, and they aren't causes or effects of what they stand for, words like chair, horse, house. And in German or French or whatever, of course, you have a different set of symbols. So those are merely habitually associated to what they stand for. Now, on my approach to consciousness, what it is to be conscious is relative to a certain class or type of signs. And you're conscious when you have the ability to use signs of that kind, and you're not inhibited from exercising that ability, as you might be if you were blindfolded or if you had a bad cold or if you were...
Give me an example of what that means.
You can smell things you'd normally smell.
So give me an example of then that understanding of consciousness in actuality, you know, in this
relationship. Well, suppose you come up to a red light at an intersection, okay? Now, the red light at the intersection, if you understand signs of that kind, there are different levels of consciousness here. You could just recognize it as an icon, which is something that resembles what it stands for. Maybe the red is the same color as your wife's dress the last time you took her out. As a cause or effect, you know, maybe if you're a maintenance worker, you come up there and you see, hey, it's stuck on red, so you realize you got to correct the mechanism so it'll change to orange and to green and so forth. But if you're a driver for the rules of the road, you know what that sign means by habitual association, apply the brakes and come to a complete halt.
Right. So there's definite signs within our culture that mean definitive things. Right.
That means
and so in terms of consciousness and the evolution of consciousness, how are signs evolving within a particular society?
Like schools where you learn the syntax of how to string together the symbols that are the words in English, you know. So you got grammar school, and you know, English is a very important component of our education at the elementary and secondary level.
Right, exactly.
And that enhances our capacity to communicate with other members of our community and to cooperate in the accomplishment of community goals, which is why sharing a common language is really an indispensable condition for a community to succeed.
Right, and then consciousness fits in there with the ability to interpret these signs on levels of meaning.
Well, it's very interesting. You start talking about perception. There are two ways to think about perception. One is as describing experience by means of language, but another deeper way is to think of subsuming sensations by means of concepts. Concepts.
Well, say that again. I think I say that again because that's a good point.
Beneath language, because most language is just words we use to refer to concepts.
Right.
What they mean is the concept. Now, take the concept of a child encounters something that it can throw, it can roll, it can chew, it can bounce. It forms the idea of things that have all these properties of being squishy, round, roly. That's the concept of a ball that is developing. Or maybe a source that is warm and nurturing that you can suckle and receive milk. You form the concept of a breast and the mother that goes with it. Or
right.
you can draw with, and you can mark on the ground or on paper with different colors, and you form the concept of chalk or maybe crayons.
So concepts then sort of in a way, and Joseph Tilton Pearson, his book, The Transcendent, says that concepts start to replace, in a way, the actuality of the experience. And in some sense, we lose our connection to what's present because we translate everything then into a concept.
Well, you can't interact with the world without concepts. What's interesting, you see, is if you define perception in terms of describing experience by means of language, then only species that have a language are going to qualify. And yet it's pretty clear that cats and dogs and other species are able to interact with their environment in appropriate ways by virtue of having corresponding concepts, even if we might argue over whether or not they have a language.
Right.
A perfect example is the vervet monkey. The vervet monkey has three different alarm calls. One alarm call stands for an airborne predator, and when a vervet monkey makes that sound, then all the other vervet monkeys rush down and hide under the brush. It has a land-borne predator sound, and when it makes that sound, then all the vervet monkeys rush up into the trees to get away from, say, a leopard. And then it has a third kind of call, and when the vervet monkeys hear that call, they climb down to see if there's something slithering around like a snake that they might find interesting to play with. So here you get the idea of the concept as what it means to you in terms of whether it's a threat or a promise and how you should interact. That your concept of something roughly is all the ways you would interact in relation to there being a thing of that kind.
Well, let me just ask you about those monkeys, because were those then calls that were taught to the tribe of monkeys, or was it more instinctual response to a certain sound, or was it learned behavior, I'm saying, or was it...
That's a very interesting question. I gave a lecture about this subject at SUNY Binghamton, and
yeah.
A woman in the audience who is a cognitive ethologist who studies, the thought processes of animals and how it affects their behavior, pointed out when I use this example or another for, say, mountain gorillas, some of the sounds they make, she said those were very common calls that were shared by many different species in the jungle. And that's very interesting because it sounds as though they're cultural phenomena. They're probably acquired. I doubt that they're instinctual or inborn, and yet there's a cultural legacy of using those kinds of sounds to represent those kinds of threats or features of the environment.
So where does language arise? Where do meanings, like, I mean, so where was the, who was the first monkey to say this means that? I mean, was it, then monkeys have their own culture in a sense is what you're saying, right?
That's correct. The example I've used, I have a book entitled The Evolution of Intelligence, Are Humans the Only Animals with Minds? And I talk about animal mind and primate mind and human mind. And there's a rather fascinating course of development here in the use of signs of different kinds. The mountain gorilla,
right,
for example, has like 10 different kinds of sounds that it makes that affect the behavior of other gorillas. And this is certainly a proto-language in relation to a human language. That you need to analyze these things from the point of view of the function they fulfill in communication situations. In English, for example, we have declarative sentences that make assertions, like that it's 10 o'clock. We have interrogative questions, interrogatory sentences that ask questions like, what time is it? We have exclamatory sentences that express emotion, like, damn. We have imperative sentences that issue commands, like, be quiet or hurry up. Now, if you look at the mountain gorilla, it turns out the mountain gorilla actually has counterparts for each of those four kinds of sentences, which is a rather fascinating result. This was one of the most interesting aspects of my research in this area, to discover that there are species, other species than humans, that have use modes of communication that fulfill all four of these different kinds of functions.
Well, so we don't really know the origins of it, but we could talk about what cognition really is, how we learn, you know, how learning and creativity take place.
Well, I think the idea of syntax or grammar actually, I think, is not as basic to language as is simply the acquisition of words that stand for properties or features of the world. Mm-hmm. And when we reach a certain degree of semantic complexity, when we have too many nouns, pronouns, adjectives, and so forth, then we need ways to organize them so that syntax actually turns out to be an emergent property. It's a property that shows up later in the evolution of language than the foundation. This is a view
that directly
contradicts the position of Noam Chomsky, for example.
Noam Chomsky says syntax shows up, and it makes sense, but then, you know, in the older languages,
syntax is innate and species-specific, right? But his views, which have been developed in the form of a thesis called The Language of Thought by Jerry Fodor, Fodor goes even further than Chomsky and says we have more than an innate syntax, we even have an innate semantics. One of the problems with that
explain that,
is that
yes.
semantics has to be so complete and comprehensive that the most primitive man had concepts for jet propulsion, color TV, polio vaccine. It turns out to be a very implausible thesis when you analyze it rigorously.
Right. So what do you think, then? Where's your understanding in all that?
Well, my view is that the concepts are fundamental and that a lot of them are acquired. Some of them are innate. In the simplest species, the lower species, they only operate in terms of, as it were, innate stimulus-response behaviors that are essentially genetic and inborn. So you can have evolution taking place when you have variation in the gene pool so that you get different responses to the same stimulus, and then the responses that turn out to be adaptive or more beneficial tend to evolve in subsequent gene pools for the lower species. But when you get to the higher species, especially human beings, we enjoy a lot of behavioral plasticity and cognitive versatility so that we can invent and extend our language, for example, which gives us the capacity to make models, mental models of the world that enable us to get around far more successfully than if we have to wait to find ourselves in a particular environment and anticipate what to do at that time.
Right. So these mental models are evolving with our culture. They're articulating, let's say, new emotions, new experiences. Wasn't it true that the ancient Greeks didn't have a distinction between blue and green until somebody came along and said, yes, this is a distinction? I mean, is that true?
Well,
in general,
you're going to have an evolution of the capacity to detect differences that make a difference to your success in surviving and reproducing. So if the difference between blue and green makes a difference, and then those organisms that have the capacity to draw that distinction and respond appropriately to blue versus green or green versus blue are going to have a higher propensity for survival and reproduction, and therefore there will be a tendency to evolve that capacity to draw distinctions. Karl Popper, the great British philosopher, provided an interesting illustration of the importance of cultural. He said, suppose you have a nuclear war, okay, and everything's destroyed in one scenario, including the libraries. But in the other scenario, everything is destroyed, but not the libraries. He said, in which case would civilization be able to reconstruct itself more rapidly? And obviously the scenario where the libraries survive, because they're repositories of knowledge, information, cultural discoveries, science, and so forth, is very helpful in allowing a species to survive and preserve. You wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel, as it were.
Right. So let's just look at a bigger picture, including where are we going now with new cultural evolutions, and also how is Darwin's understanding, in a sense, wrong about our evolutionary process?
Well, what Darwin did was to discover a key mechanism of evolution, which is that, you know, you have this adaptive capacity, that there's a competition between the members of the same species for resources that are limited resources, like food and shelter. And Darwin discovered there are really three fundamental tenets of classic evolutionary theory. One is the observation of Malthus, the statistician
right,
and demographer
social
that
historian,
made everyone
yes.
alive to each species and then survived to reproduce, then Darwin
right.
sought to explain why some reproduce and others didn't on the basis of the theory of natural selection, so that those with the traits that enable them to succeed in competition with other members have a higher propensity to survive and reproduce. And then Mendel, Gregor Mendel, discovered that there was this genetic property that was the basis for the inherited characteristics. Actually, Darwin was doing his research without having the benefit of the concept of genes. So when you integrate the notion of genetics with the natural selection and the recognition that more are born live than survive to reproduce, you get the basis for evolutionary theory today. But there are multiple additional mechanisms of evolution.
Well, what about the Lamarck's idea about intentional evolution?
Well,
you go on with that species evolved because
it's
somewhere an intention to match the environment.
But yet Popper is pointing out there's a sense in which cultural evolution has a Lamarckian dimension, because once you've invented the wheel, you don't have to reinvent it again. So you get the benefit of culture to the point at which it has developed when you're born into it. So that's a form of acquired characteristics that's distinctive of culture as opposed to genetic evolution.
Well, I think the genetics do reflect, I mean, the cultural evolution. I just look at language, look at the evolution of language. You know, it goes through many permutations, but the way it evolves somehow matches a sort of natural evolution, don't you think? The way
let's put it this way. The mechanisms of culture of cultural evolution include laws of conditioning, you know, classic conditioning, instrumental conditioning, imitative learning, the capacity to teach, the capacity to learn. All these are mechanisms whereby an individual's behavior can be modified after they are born. And it can go on. You can have many changes and modifications to your behavior after you're born, and yet your genes remain the same for the entire duration of your life. So the genetic evolution produces
just
properties that are rooted in your genes.
There are a whole lot of other things. But the thing I want to really know is how then do now this new computer age affect the evolution of consciousness and what we're cognizant of, what we can realize on a larger scale?
Well, what computers do many things. What they do is supplement our mental operations. For example, most computers can do a much better job of elementary mathematical operations than most people can do. There are catches, however, because there are internal limitations in the precision of computers when you get to large numbers. There's a function of registers with computers where you're talking about numbers larger than the registers can represent. They have to introduce round-offs. And when you start multiplying numbers where you've rounded them off, you can create mistakes that will lead to a factory that's been automated sticking a steel beam through the ceiling instead of processing it on the conveyor belt because of the accumulation of round-off errors. But computers also have
addition of computers will affect our cultural evolution in terms of consciousness. You know what I'm asking? So,
well, I see what you're saying. My argument is that actually the principles on which computers operate are fundamentally different than the principles on which human minds operate. In fact, I have another book entitled Consciousness and Cognition: Why Minds Are Not Machines. And there are two key differences. One is computers operate purely on the basis of manipulating marks, given their shapes, sizes, and relative locations, independent of any meaning they may have. Human beings operate in terms of signs, things that do have some meaning, that stand for something for the human being. So that's one fundamental difference. I refer to that as the static difference. But there's also something called the dynamic difference, because computers operate on the basis of algorithms, which are encoded into programs, which makes them, as it were, in a certain sense, mechanical. Human beings have thought transitions that appear to be distinctive from person to person as a function of your life history and the emotional importance of the experiences you've had. So, you know, two human beings should look at the same situation and react very differently because of their life
capacity
and the emotional
invention
experience.
Of new ideas. They can't take things to the next level of something that hasn't been known before.
The internet, for example, enables people to communicate far more rapidly, far more frequently over great distances than could ever be done before. I mean, that's a way in which computers enhance communication between humans. That's a huge benefit right there.
Right. I mean, I know it's a benefit, but I just was wondering if you see a bigger picture, and this is, we're almost out of time, of how computers will evolve the whole culture to the next level of interaction and being together and a great society.
It's a lot like automobiles, you know. I mean, the automobile has brought about a lot of benefits because it enhances our mobility, our capacity to travel distances and amounts of time. And there are all kinds of refinements that take place with automobiles, that some can travel faster, more comfortably, with more amenities. With computers, they're great for communication and for processing and solving certain classes of problems that are, especially ones that are difficult for humans to undertake. So it's a great supplement to human problem-solving ability. But it's not the case that computers can replace human minds, which have distinctive properties that computers lack.
Well, one of those distinctive properties is our ability to create something out of nothing, our ability for novelty and invention. That's something a computer will never have. But, you know, I do think computers will propel the society to another level of cohesiveness and harmony. This is where I'm really going.
Well, I would like to believe that, and that we'll all be able to have complete, freedom of access to our computers, and the government won't seek to regulate them and use them against us. But I'm afraid I don't know of any technology that, you know, has the capacity to extend the power of a government that a government hasn't sought to use to extend its own power. So, I mean, that's a great danger today. There are notices out there, reports that the Pentagon is viewing the Internet as an enemy and wants to control it. So I think all of us have to be very concerned that the government may try to crack down on the Internet. That's one of our last bastions of freedom of speech and freedom of inquiry and freedom of communication.
Well, James, I'm really glad you put that in there, because that is probably the most important thing, is to keep our freedom, you know, and that's why radio stations like this one, bbsradio.com, are very important, because it gives a greater power of speech. If people want to get in touch with you or reach you or find out more about you, what would we tell them?
Well, you can just do a Google on Jim Fetzer, and you'll find my homepage, my academic homepage, and you'll find all of my books and everything. You'll find a lot about me right there. It just starts off and says Jim Fetzer was born in Pasadena.
Okay, that's F-E-T-Z-E-R, James.
Right.
Thank you for being a guest
just like
on New
the
Realities,
one.
And I'll give you a call soon.
My great pleasure, Alan. Thank you for having
me
on.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you.
You got
Maria,
it.
That's another show. We're almost out of time. Do you have anything to tell our guests?
No, that was great. I was enthralled.
But what about next? What about signing off?
What about signing off?
What did you say about people's reality that you wanted to tell them? You know, you had a little saying that you wanted to end with. Go ahead. What was that thing that you came up with?
Oh, about are you sleepwalking through your life? Is it time for a wake-up call, people? Wake up, baby.
And thank you for watching New Realities. My name is Alan Steinfeld. And I'm here with Maria. What's your name?
Maria Merilli.
Maria Merilli, of course. And you can catch me every week on BBS Radio at 6:30 p.m. California time, West Coast time, or 9:30 East Coast time. And you can reach me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Check out my website, which is newrealities.tv. And I'm going to end with a song. And I always take phone calls. If you have something to comment about the show, you can always call me at 212-473-6388. I'm going to have some very exciting upcoming shows with Bruce Lipton about the evolution of consciousness. We're going to do more UFO shows. We'll probably do some more astronomy. We'll talk more about art and science. So thank you for listening, and I'm going to end with this song by Duke Williams and the Extremes called Night Before the Future. So this is it, Duke Williams and the Extremes.
Oh, on Albert Hall. Come on,
take it away, or did you think you better off staying in bed and not doing a thing but relaxing your head? Just remember, the things you see might not quite be your own reality. The dimensions exist within you, Vienna, and then you know you're just a beginner. Because life just starts, and when it ends, it turns around and then it's getting done.
Let that spirit.